Welcome back to the Reading and Writing Podcast. I'm joined on the podcast today by Susan Wells, author of the new nonfiction book, An Assassin in Utopia, the true story of a 19th century sex cult and a president's murder. Chris Connolly, an ABC News correspondent and ESPN reporter, wrote about the book, Juggling Incels and Libertines, The Mighty and the Mightily Deranged. Susan Wells definitely brings us this close to an amazing cast of real-life 19th century characters, admirable and horrific, brilliant and doomed, messianic and utterly mad, making them and their vivid emotions newly relatable to our era. You'll be casting an assassin in Utopia in your head, even as it demonstrates that free love is anything but, and that one man can make a difference, often in the worst way possible. This is like David McCullough on acid. Susan, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you so much for having me, Jeff.
That's a great quote, by the way.
Yes, it is.
Well, I'm wondering if someone hasn't heard about your book yet, An Assassin in Utopia, can you explain the story that you researched and wrote about here?
Sure. Well, it's the first book to trace the links between a utopian free love community in upstate New York and the 1881 assassination of President Garfield, because the assassin had been a member of that community for 6 years. But beyond that, it also traces some crazy, surprising connections between a lot of eccentric and famous people like Horace Greeley and P.T. Barnum. They were all sort of connected to the story and the time. And it also explores the cultural trends that run through the 19th century, from utopias to patronage-dealing politicians, spiritual mediums, visionaries, hoaxers, and hucksters like P.T. Barnum.
How did you first learn about the Oneida community?
I first learned about it when I was a graduate student in history. I read about the Oneida community, and my jaw was literally hitting the floor, or at least in my mind, because I couldn't believe what they were doing in Victorian America from the 1840s until around 1880. It just kind of blew my mind. And because I'm a writer, I had it in the back of my mind that I always wanted to write about the Oneida community, but I didn't want to write an academic book, and there have been some very fine books written about it. I thought that if I could find a crime committed by somebody in the Oneida community, I would have a story. I would have a human interest way into it. The problem was I couldn't find a crime, because despite their exotic practices, the Oneida community they were considered the pillars of their community. They were entirely upright. They provided a lot of employment for their neighbors. They were very, very prosperous. And nobody did anything wrong that I could detect. So literally, as a last-ditch effort, in 2009, the New York Times had recently put their archives online. And I thought there was a minuscule chance that if a crime had been committed in upstate New York, the New York Times would have reported on it. So I literally typed into the search bar, Oneida community crime, and I got an avalanche of hits. I mean, so many that I couldn't even focus on them. And when I finally was able to start reading, it was a presidential assassination. And at that moment, I realized I had a book, and I had a huge amount of work in front of me, because obviously it was a much bigger crime than I ever expected to find.
You kind of laughed and kind of alluded to it just a moment ago, your surprise at what you discovered when you first heard about the Oneida community. But for someone listening, can you tell us a little bit about their practices and beliefs? And I want to frame this by reminding people who are listening that we're talking about the early 1800s here, which is kind of mind-blowing. But can you tell us a little bit about kind of what they believed and what they practiced in their community?
Sure. They were founded in 1848, and it was within a religious context. The founder of it, a man named John Humphrey Noyes, described the Oneida community as a miniature model of the kingdom of heaven on earth. But he had a very strange idea of what was going on in the kingdom of heaven. He believed in group marriage, lovemaking in the Oneida community was the highest form of worship, and it was performed according to his regulations. And it was, he considered it a refined skill that would take its place among the fine arts, ranking above music, painting, and sculpture. It was a very interesting phenomenon, especially during Victorian America. But I have to say that this was a time following the Revolutionary War when institutions and traditions were shattered. And so charismatic leaders filled the void with all kinds of experimental social structures. And the Oneida community was one of about at least 70 utopian communities that sprung up during that era, like mushrooms. The only thing I can really kind of compare it to would be the 1960s, when, again, it was a time of real social ferment, and there were a lot of experimental social communities that arose.
And if I'm not mistaken, and maybe you could put this in context, and I maybe should have researched before asking this, but aren't we talking about the same area and the same time period when the founder of Mormonism, wasn't that originally started in upstate New York sometime around this time?
You're right that Mormonism was founded in upstate New York, Joseph Smith, but that was in the 1820s. So okay. This was a little bit later, but but you're exactly right that there was so much of this experimentation going on in upstate New York that it was later referred to as the burned over district. I mean, it was just full of stuff, including the Shakers and, you know, all kinds of experiments. So the Oneida community, you know, was right in line with that. But what really set it apart is that it was the most successful utopian community in American history. With all of its strangeness, it lasted for more than 30 years.
Because you talked about looking at the archives at the New York Times and periodicals and primary sources of the day, given what we know about kind of the religious fervor in the U.S.'s founding, especially for the, you know, this time period of like the mid-1800s, what was the reaction at the time to the Oneida community and their beliefs about sex and relationships?
Well, that was one of the very surprising things. Because this was such a time of social ferment, and there were so many of these experiments going on. In fact, Ralph Waldo Emerson said that every thinking man has a plan for a new community in his pocket. I mean, that's how common this was. It was the age of the individual. Horace Greeley, the famous newspaper editor, said, "A man can do as he pleases and create his own world." And so this was very much the spirit of the times. It was an age of singularity. And when the Oneida community arose, they didn't hide what they did. In fact, they published newspapers and annual reports describing in detail what their philosophy and practices were. And they attracted a lot of people who wanted to join them. And some very famous people became advocates for them because it was just a time of experimentation. And I think this is something that we forget about American history. We really don't learn about the decades before the Civil War. We don't realize that it was this time of kind of magical experimentation and all kinds of very unique ideas. We've forgotten about it.
Spring is in the air at Littleton Coin Company, and we want to help you brighten your collection. Visit us at littletoncoin.com all month long to enjoy 15% off your purchase. With a wide selection of coins, paper money, supplies, and more, Littleton Coin Company has something for every collector's taste. Use promo code SPRING at littletoncoin.com for 15% off your purchase all month long. Restrictions apply. Littleton Coin Company, serving collectors since 1945.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Hey, Drew Scott here.
And I'm Jonathan Scott, reminding you that life's better with a home policy from American Family Insurance. They can help you get just the right protection at just the right price and help you save when you bundle home and auto. Kind of like Goldilocks and the Three Bears. It'll be just right for you. We love a custom build. American Family Insurance. Insure carefully. Dream fearlessly. Get a quote and find an agent at AmFam.com.
Products not available in every state. Visit AmFam.com to learn how discounts may apply to you. American Family Mutual Insurance Company, S.I. and its operating company, 6000 American Parkway, Madison, Wisconsin.
That's interesting. Well, obviously, you know, your book, as we talked about in the title and earlier in this interview, that there is this connection between the Oneida community and later the assassination of President Garfield. And I'll probably get his name wrong. Did Charles Julius and Guiteau, did he ever explain his motivation for assassinating President Garfield?
He certainly did. He wrote a lot about it. But first, I'll talk about his connection with the Oneida community.
Yes.
His father actually grew up in upstate New York and knew about John Humphrey Noyes and the Oneida community and was a devotee. And even after he moved his family to the Midwest, he always had it in the back of his mind that he wanted to join it. He never did. But in 1860, his son, Charles Julius Guiteau, was living in Ann Arbor, Michigan, and pursuing studies and failing miserably at them. So he started corresponding with the Oneida community, asking for admission. And after a long correspondence, they finally agreed to let him in. But it soon became very clear that he was an oddball. He was excitable with a quick temper. He would mutter and gesture mysteriously when he was angry. He hated to work. And the women in the Oneida community did not like him. In fact, they started calling him Get Out instead of Guiteau. So he had a difficult road there. But he had such a maniacally inflated ego that he believed that he should take over for John Humphrey Noyes as head of the community. And he even believed that he should become president of the United States. So it was clear that Guiteau was demented, even when he was 19 and in his early 20s. By time he assassinated President Garfield in 1881, he had become even more delusional. And the connection between the Oneida community and the assassination of James Garfield, I discovered, really was because of this very famous newspaper man, Horace Greeley, who was sort of the publishing icon of his time. If you can imagine, in the pre-Civil War years, really from 1830 to 1860, newspapers were, there was a startup boom in the newspaper business. Newspapers were like the internet of the era. Mm-hmm. And sort of the thought leader, the Steve Jobs, was Horace Greeley, who had founded the New York Tribune in 1841. John Humphrey Noyes, the leader of the Oneida community, was obsessed with Horace Greeley and newspapers and wanted to create a daily theocratic newspaper. Well, Charles Guiteau, copying everything that John Humphrey Noyes did, also got it in his mind that he wanted to follow in Horace Greeley's footsteps. And he actually even applied for a job with Horace Greeley, did not get it because he had no skills whatsoever. But in 1872, Horace Greeley ran for president. And Charles Guiteau decided that if he wrote a speech for Horace Greeley and campaigned for him, when Horace Greeley won, which he believed he inevitably would, and he went to the White House, he would be so indebted to Charles Guiteau that he would give him an appointment as a foreign minister to another country, basically an ambassador.
Right.
It was completely delusional, but he wrote the speech and he was actually allowed to give it at a few outdoor rallies in 1872. Well, Horace Greeley lost the election in a truly horrible way, which I describe in the book. But that was the template for his connection to James Garfield, because when Garfield ran for president in 1880, Charles Guiteau had the same idea. He rewrote his speech for Horace Greeley as a campaign speech for James Garfield, and he actually gave it on some important occasions with the full expectation that when Garfield won and went to the White House, he would appoint Guiteau as minister to Paris. Well, he didn't do that. And I would say that Guiteau's disappointment was one of the reasons why he assassinated James Garfield, but it was not the only reason. There were other political pressures on him and other delusional reasons why he did it.
Sure. And can you remind those who are listening who may not remember from their history books, can you tell us about the assassination?
Yeah, the assassination happened in 1881. On July 2nd. Well, actually, that wasn't the assassination. That was the shooting, because right. Garfield lingered on for another 10 weeks after the shooting. What happened was Guiteau had been stalking Garfield for weeks, following him wherever he went when he left the White House. He even had it in his mind that he was going to shoot him in church. He ended up not doing that, but the newspapers would publish the president's schedule, where he was going, and he was leaving town on a much-needed month-long vacation on July 2nd, and Guiteau waited in the train station, and when Garfield walked through, Guiteau shot him 2 times. And interestingly, it wasn't the bullets that killed Garfield. It was the infection caused by the dirty hands of the doctors who attended him, who kept searching for the bullet and couldn't find it.
Wow. So what is the research process for you for a book such as An Assassin in Utopia?
It was very long. I could say that. It took me more than 12 years to research and write this book. And one of the reasons is that I kept finding these astonishing connections between very, very interesting people who we know their names, but we really don't know much about them. But they were all kind of connected to this story. And so I wanted to just almost present this as an assassination story, but also a lens into the time, because it was such an interesting time in American history. It was sort of the offbeat underside of the American story. That's what I wanted to tell. Anyway, I kept finding, it was like a cabinet of curiosity. I would follow, I would pull one thread and it would take me into something unbelievable. And then I'd pull another thread and they would be connected. And they all connected to either Guiteau, to Garfield, to Greeley, or to the assassination, or to Oneida. It was kind of remarkable. So I wrote this book for my own enjoyment, and it's just absolutely delightful that it's finding an audience.
Have you started thinking about a topic for your next book?
Well, I have. I don't know that I'm ready to talk about it,
sure.
It's another collection of really interesting, intersecting people. You know, the late, great David McCullough said that history is about human beings, and it really is. It's not about dates and events. It's about the connections between human beings and their foibles and their passions and their talents and their failures, and how those things interacting with other people create the events that change and shape human history. So that's what I like to write about. And I've perhaps found another story that may be worth telling.
What writing advice would you offer for those who might want to write a compelling historical nonfiction book?
I would follow David McCullough's advice that history is human. It's about human beings. So find the story about the individuals who are making history and their very human motivations for their decisions, because that's really the part of history that people connect to. And I think if you can find that and not just talk about the events themselves. You will have the potential to really pull in your readers and make them care.
What books have you read recently that you enjoyed?
Well, I would have to say I love David McCullough's Mornings on Horseback. I think that's a fantastic book. Of course, Devil in the White City by Eric Larson. I loved Candace Millard's book, on Teddy Roosevelt. All of them are very, very human stories of events that we know less about than we might think. And they just pull you into the time. It's like time traveling, but also into the emotional experience of the protagonists. And it's all true. You can't make this stuff up, which is why I love writing history.
Where can people find you online if they want to learn more about you and your book?
I have a website, SusanWellsAuthor.com, and that's Wells with one L. You can also find me on Amazon. You can find me in many bookstores. And I really hope everybody who reads the book enjoys it.
That's wonderful. Well, again, we've been speaking to Susan Wells, author of the new nonfiction book, An Assassin in Utopia, The True Story of a 19th Century Sex Cult and a President's Murder. The book is available now, so go buy a copy. And Susan, thanks for doing this interview.
You're so welcome. Thanks for having me, Jeff.
Absolutely. Thanks a lot.
Ready for a career in behavioral health? Earn your online degree at Herzing University. Choose from health and human services, psychology, or social work programs. Gain the skills to work, coordinate, and manage nonprofits. Secure a bachelor's in psychology to study mental health or advance your social work career through our online Masters of Social Work. Let us help you become a social change agent. Your future starts now at Herzing University. Text HEALTH to 85109. That's HEALTH to 85109. Or visit herzing.edu.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.